This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Now, moving on to politics, Sri Lanka has held the elections. And we've seen, after years of policy gridlock and terror attacks, we've seen citizens in Sri Lanka bring back the return of the controversial, actually, Rajapaksa family in the form of Gotabaya Rajapaksa. Now, he scooped the votes of the country's Sinhalese Buddhist majority, which is interesting. Official results show that he beat predictions of a close result with an emphatic 52% of the vote. And this is against 42% for his opponent, Sajith Premadasa.
Now, Rajapaksa is seen as analyst, as a strong man figure, the kind of authoritarian politician who has come to power in many countries across the world. For example, you can even look at the USA, I guess.
Of course.
And Saravamuttu, head of the Center for Policy Alternatives, a think tank in Colombo, he did say what happened in April, when he's referring to those terror attacks, reinforced Rajapaksa's. Now, voters are saying what we need is strong leadership, someone who understands what security is all about.
Now, of course, the last time one of his family was in power was his brother, Mahendra, who ruled for a 10-year period between 2005 to 2015. And I guess the whole question of whether this is, you know, going to be a family dynasty of politicians. Mahendra was a charismatic figure who had a more devoted political following than, of course, the current Rajapaksa. Now, the current guy is now expected to seek the position of prime minister in parliamentary polls at a deal within months. And now with Gotabaya as president, experts see it much more likely that voters will back Mahendra for prime minister. And I guess this is really in response to the April terror attacks. And, you know, very much like it was in Philippines with Duterte, I think people do like authority. People do like that assertiveness in their leadership. They don't like that toing and froing.
But does it actually resolve any problems at the end of the day? I mean, is this a good sign of that democracy is alive and
correct.
Well?
Will it spell the death knell for democracy, right? I think that's the other
will we then
question.
Have all these human rights abuses which were levelled at the Rajapaksas before they lost the elections? I mean, fair enough, they were fighting a war. But there were also allegations that perhaps the army was not always acting in the best interest of the Sri Lankans.
No, it's the economy. I think their last quarterly growth numbers was 1.6%, which is not great in the context of developing economies in Asia. Now, Kusal Pereira, a newspaper columnist in Sri Lanka, said that the country could now take a similar direction to Narendra Modi's India, where the religion of the majority is ascendant politically. And that's interesting because they sit north of Sri Lanka, obviously. Now, he said that this election has legitimized the Sinhala Buddhist theocratic state. There won't be any democratic space left for other voices.
Yeah, he also warns that under Mahendra, detractors said that free speech is likely to be curtailed and critics in the past were abducted while they forged relations with extremist Buddhist groups. Now, a UN investigation found during Mahinda's regime, which saw the defeat of the liberation of the Tigers of Tamil Eelam, there were allegations, like I said, of human rights abuses, with the last few months of the fighting in particular leading to large-scale civilian casualties.
Yeah, of course, what happens in Sri Lanka will take a lot of interest among Malaysians because we do have a lot of Sinhalese.
Diaspora, yes.
Yes, among us. Now, in the context of the US-China trade war, Mahendra was very clearly a pro-China politician. He brought Sri Lanka very close to Beijing. They signed up for billions of dollars worth of infrastructure projects to be built by China. However, under the outgoing government, before Gotabaya came into power, Sri Lanka moved closer to the US and its regional ally, India. And of course, Sri Lanka, as it stands right now, until this particular election, had become a new logistics hub for the US Navy in the Indian Ocean because Washington wanted to counter China in the Indo-Pacific region. Now, this hither and thither now brings back Sri Lanka avowedly to China.
Yeah, Rajapaksa appear to be open to doing more infrastructure projects with China. And, you know, we can bring this back home, right? We have to draw parallels here. I think initially at the beginning of the Pakatan Harapan government, shortly after GE14, there was this like, hold on, what are we doing? Are we going to do a lot more infrastructure projects with China? Does it make any sense? So we kind of stopped all the ECRL, we stopped Bandar Malaysia, and then we took a step back, right? And we looked at our fiscal finances and say, this is terrible. You know, the amount that we're spending and the multiplier effect doesn't look good. So there was this little bit of hoo-hoo, you know, frooing with China. Okay, everything, stop.
Yeah.
But guess what? We've kind of resurrected everything again, haven't we, Chuang? Except the quantums have been much less.
Yeah, so that's the thing, right? Under close scrutiny of the terms of the contract with the East Coast Rail Link, it would have been, I mean, clear to anybody possible that there was going to be some element of economic colonialism with regard to the payment to Chinese bankers and Chinese infrastructure projects. And I think quite wisely, to Pakatan's credit, they did redraw the terms of the agreement and they did, you know, pull back on the quantums involved.
Yeah, so now it's $30 billion.
Half what it was, right?
Yeah, but it's still a lot of money, and then there's still the question of the multiplier effect. But the point is, with Rajapaksa's back in power, it looks like, and also recently Xi Jinping's visit to Greece, you know, and Greece surprisingly is one of the major players in this Belt Road Initiative. It does look like China is back again in terms of doing its checkbook diplomacy and pushing ahead with its Belt Road Initiatives and using its superpower might to kind of also kind of encourage all this economic cooperation.
Yeah, I wonder how much that is going to have a bearing on the U.S.-China trade talks as well, because obviously the U.S.-China trade talks is not all about the business that those two countries do. It's about who's got the bragging rights in terms of the number one dog in the world. Now, switching to Hong Kong, now, we talked about this a few, you know, over the course of the last few weeks, it's been getting worse and worser and worser.
Schools are closed, by the way.
Schools are closing. University campuses have become battlefields. There's a picture in the Financial Times of a student in a gas mask adopting a bow hunter's pose, shooting an arrow at police.
Which you would never, ever imagine
very
would
apocalyptic.
Happen in Hong Kong. I mean, it used to be one of the safest places in Asia, right? It was a place
used to be.
I mean, you never imagined there would be actually kind of semi-warfare on the streets.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I never thought I'll see a bow and arrow in Hong Kong.
Now, what we have overnight is that the police launched the late-night operation. They tried to flush out about 200 protesters of a university campus. This clash, an officer was hit in the leg with an arrow. Massive barrages of tear gas and water cannons were fired. Riot police began moving in on one group of protesters outside the campus. After issuing an ultimatum for people to leave the area, they used tear gas, water cannons, and a resistant crowd wearing raincoats and carrying umbrellas. And then protesters were using bows and arrows. Earlier in the day, one arrow struck a media liaison officer in the calf. At least the firing of the legs, not of the head. But that's still, I mean, that's still apocalyptic.
Yeah, I mean, and as riot police moved in from all sides, some of the protesters retreated inside Hong Kong's Polytechnic University, while others set fire on bridges leading to it. Now, they also used gasoline bombs, and they launched it like catapults, threatening to escalate the violence in the more than 5-month-long anti-government movement. Now, it seems like the protesters are trying to keep the pressure on Hong Kong leaders, who, of course, have rejected most of their demands. But what's worrying, Chuang, is that I don't see what resolution or how there can be a resolution.
Can't be. It can only get ugly because China is not going to, it's not going to give Hong Kong what Hong Kongers want, because they were always on borrowed time, weren't they? I think 2048 is the deadline. 2047.
But in the meantime, basic law was supposed to continue. So you can imagine if you're a student, right, and you think, you know, this is not happening. Every day my rights are being eroded. There's a question whether the government service is independent, whether the judiciary is independent. In the meantime, the backdrop, just like Malaysia, is the bread and butter issues, right? I can't afford a house. I can't get a job. My job pays me too little. All these issues weigh down on Hong Kongers' minds. And initially, the protest we saw was, you know, peaceful. As many as, 2 million people turned up? And now they've taken a decidedly very militant approach. I don't know. Does this mean that Hong Kongers still support the students? I wonder.
I don't know. It's been 5 months in the making. One only hopes that there's some kind of peaceful resolution, but one doesn't get a sense that there will be.
Because the economy is starting to feel the effects of this, right? And I mean, if we look back at the umbrella movement about 7-8 years ago, the umbrella movement eventually petered out because local Hong Kongers got angry. They got annoyed. Their rice bowl issues were impacted. They couldn't have businesses. And eventually, you know, the protesters then didn't have the support of the locals. I wonder whether we'll eventually get to that, or do Hong Kongers really still think, okay, these students have a point?
Of course, and only time will tell, hopefully peacefully. Now, up next, we'll be speaking to Julia Goh, senior economist with UOB Malaysia, on the economy, Q3 GDP numbers, and whether we'll see another rate cut soon. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.